Tonight, I want to talk about deep stories. Deep stories. That's a term coined by the sociologist Arlie Hochschild. And she uses it to talk about a metaphor, an image, or a narrative that describes some dimension of how we see reality. And the story, she says, is often a collective story or even a mythic story that is beneath all of our mind's daily stories. And these deep stories, whether they're collective or personal or mythic, they can be vitally helpful or important, helpful or harmful to our health, our well-being, even how we see the world, the meaning of life itself. Much of my hospital chaplaincy work was listening to people's stories, especially their deep stories, and helping them come into some kind of wise or healthy relationship with those narratives, particularly towards the end of life. It's such a vital role of spiritual care that Chaplain Rebecca Schmidt, palliative care chaplain, referred to herself as a human story catcher. Right? A human story catcher. And hearing stories, rehearing them, retelling them in fresh ways helps to reframe them. And that in turn helps each person to come to terms with, cope, heal, let go into change, let go into a new way of being. Often, as you all know, most of you know anyway, meditation is for good reason, emphasizes finding space from, disidentification from our stories. And I'll quote here, this is David Loy talks about a type of freedom. Buddhist practice brings a type of freedom that results from understanding how stories construct or constrict possibilities. And from getting a little bit of space, distance from that. So that's often the function of meditation, is right, is to begin to see mental events as mental events. That said, as many of you have no doubt discovered in your own lives or in the lives of those around you, there's a big role for noticing how stories influence us and for finding ones that influence us for the better. So tonight I'm going to talk about some of the Buddha's stories because the Buddha had his own narratives, his own way of seeing things and doing things that in turn in his lifetime and in the millennia since have inspired many more people to change their stories for the better. So many of you know these. This is going to be a tour for some of you through some of the kind of old wisdom tales in this tradition. But the Buddha was born the side of a riverbank in a park, Lumbini, halfway between his parents' palace and his mom's family home, because the tradition in ancient India was that a woman went back to the house of her parents to give birth. And he was born, unfortunately, as you can imagine, child labor was very difficult in ancient India, the Bronze Age. His mom died shortly thereafter. And he was raised by his aunt, later known as Mahapachapati. And kind of myth sort of surrounds those early days. Like, apparently, when as in the few days his mother was alive, a great seer encountered the family in Lumbini Park and predicted that this baby would either become a great leader, like a king, or a spiritual teacher, great spiritual teacher. Well, his father had definite opinions about which one of those he would prefer the Buddha to be. So he cloistered him, protected him, gave him every single luxury you could imagine, It was said even at night on the palace grounds, people would go around and deadhead the flowers so that the Buddha wouldn't even see a dying flower. Everything was kept pristine. He was given every advantage, a lot of entertainment, an excellent education, and yet, as young people will, was restless and escaped the palace on several occasions with his charioteer. And there, out in the town, unscripted, he had these four encounters with aging, sickness, and death, an old person, a sick person, and a dying person. And if you can imagine being so naive, so protected, that you have to ask your friend, "What's wrong with that person?" "Well, they're sick." "What is sick?" Right? And an aged person, "What's going on with them?" "Well, they're old." And having explained what age is, and then a dead person. And I can imagine, we could imagine this is quite upsetting. And then there was the glimpse of a sage walking through at total peace in all of the chaos and all of the suffering. And that apparently inspired the young Buddha to want to come to a place to end suffering. So there's this really ancient little snippet of narrative in the Pali Canon that talks about him leaving. And this is a quote. "So while still young, a black-haired young man endowed with the blessings of youth in the first stage of life, and while my parents, unwilling, were crying with tears streaming down their faces, I shaved off my hair and beard, put on a robe, and went forth from the home life into homelessness." So he went off and wandered. And any version of this story, his determination shows through. Striving, excelling, multiple spiritual teachers, concentration states, and eventually coming to a point where he and a small band of other practitioners were practicing austerities. A single grain of rice a day was what he supposedly got down to in terms of eating. And he, in other parts of the ancient teachings, he talks about being able to see or touch his backbone through his belly, if you can imagine. Yeah, not healthy, right? He was becoming weak, and at one point was lying by the side of the road, mistaken for dead, when a memory came up within him. And this memory was him as a young boy, like, I don't know, 7 to 10 years old, somewhere in there, sitting in his father's estate under a rose apple tree, looking down over the fields as the harvest was being harvested. And it was cool. He was comfortable and very relaxed and just sort of had sunk into, expanded into this really natural, beautiful state. And at that point, the recognition came to him in the midst of all this austerity. Oh, pleasure is not to be feared, especially spiritual pleasure. And perhaps it's not a coincidence that not long after that, a kind woman came by and took pity on him. He tried to move, I guess, or get her attention in some way. And she cradled his head in her lap and fed her his own lunch, some rice porridge. And that kindness, that compassion, that receiving of generosity, together with that memory, that relational generosity lifted him out of this austerity mindset. He went from a place of self-denial to a place of accepting the beauty of the practice, the beauty of life around him, and the relationality. Later, another little snippet of the Buddha's story is the night of his enlightenment. Mara, the namesake of death, or symbolizes life-denying forces, came to him, bringing every force to bear, sense desire, ill will, horrible visions of all kinds, in order to try to prevent this breakthrough of awakening. And it's said that Mara's armies had arrows and weapons they were hurling, metaphorically, just all kinds of awful stuff. And that the Buddha's wisdom transformed all of them into a shower of flowers, of nourishment, as these horrible forces came towards him. I think this is such a beautiful image, the aware, wise heart metabolizing difficulty into beauty. Finally, Mara taunts the Buddha with doubt. You don't deserve to be here. You don't deserve to wake up. And as many of you know and have seen in statues, the Buddha simply reached down and touched the earth. The earth as my witness. I belong here. I belong here. It's said in the later mythic stories that the earth shook at his touch, that he was invoking the power of the earth around him. I think of it as the power of being grounded in your own seat, our own place on the earth, in nature, in the earth. And then lastly, after his awakening, it said, which happened that night, by the way, it said that the Buddha turned around, walked a little distance away, and sat staring at the Bodhi tree that had sheltered him. He sat there staring for 7 days in gratitude. 7 days of gratitude. Gratitude for shelter, for the support of conditions, for nature itself. And he spent the rest of his life traveling, practicing, and largely teaching in forests, parks, outdoors. It's almost hard to imagine now, isn't it, in our day and age? So then it's also said that after his awakening, one of his first thoughts was, this cannot be taught. This can't be taught. And a being came to him, again, a myth, Brahma Sahapati, intervenes, imploring him to teach. There are people, there are beings with little dust clouding their eyes. Please teach. And I think of this process, whether we psychologize it as an internal process or treat it as a myth, that it dispels a different kind of doubt. Archetypally, this is dispelling the doubt of one's capacity to benefit others in the world, and the doubt, dispelling the doubt in their capacity to transform, right? So, as I mentioned earlier, as you all know, if you're here, the Buddha inspired countless others through the ages, then and now, to change their lives, change their stories, how they related to their internal experiences for the better. The archetypal distillation of this is going forth into a life of practice. And there's this quote that I just love, abandoning the killing of living beings with weapons laid aside, conscientious, merciful, abiding, compassionate towards all living beings. That's the impulse that he inspired in hundreds of monks and nuns in his lifetime, and in hundreds and thousands of people in lifetimes since. Can we imagine the difference in our world if everyone committed just to that? Just to that, nothing else. So I'll maybe this will be close to the end, a particularly powerful example of the Buddha changing someone's life story. I'll start with the beginning of this young man's story. It was a man named Ahimsa by his parents. For those of you who don't know, Ahimsa literally in Pali and Sanskrit means non-harming. It's a beautiful name. And his parents were not rich, but they recognized this young man had incredible potential. He was charming, he was kind, he was open, he was very smart and spiritually inclined. So, at a certain point, maybe in his adolescence, young adolescence, they scraped together their resources to send him to a spiritual school with a reputable teacher some distance away. They did what they could to give him the best shot at the best life he could have. And he arrived there and quickly became the favorite of the teacher. Charming, smart, utterly sincere, right? Unfortunately, this inspired the envy of the other adolescents at the school. Some things kind of don't change, right? And they started getting catty and gossiping and doing those things. And it apparently got to be quite a toxic situation where these kids got together, or young men mostly got together and colluded to try to break the close relationship that Ahimsa had formed with this spiritual teacher. Kind of their own internal fake news campaign, going to the teacher in little groups or one by one, telling him fake stories and undermining stories that Ahimsa had turned against the teacher, that he was plotting against the teacher, this and that and the other. And the teacher at first just didn't believe it, dismissed it over and over, but eventually all of these different perspectives were coming and they were all bad. And so the teacher is turned against his favorite student. And he comes up with a grotesque assignment that he does not expect Ahimsa to do in order to get him to go away. Basically says, Ahimsa, you've got one final stage in your spiritual development you absolutely need to do, and you need to trust me on this. You need to go away, and you need to kill at least 100 people and come back with proof that you've killed them. I want their fingers. Ahimsa's horrified. No, I can't do that. And the teacher convinces him he has to leave and go do this. And he ends up becoming the most notorious mass murderer of his day, a man that came to be known as Angulimala. Many of you have heard his name, I think, in different stories, right? So the backstory is that he was basically lied to and betrayed into becoming this grotesque, violent person. Well, he put himself towards it and he became just terribly, understandably feared and probably went a little out of his mind in the process of doing this. Sometime later, the Buddha is going through that part of India and is asked not to enter the forest where he is. There's like cadres of soldiers out searching this murderer down. It's like, well, we can't find him, but we know he's somewhere in there. Don't go in there. And the Buddha just calmly walks into the forest alone, wanting to prevent this man from killing one more person. And so he's walking, walking. And the story is that Angulimala is only one finger away from completing his horrible task. And he sees this monk. And he's like, ah, that's it, a monk. And starts running towards him. The Buddha's calmly walking, walking, walking. Angulimala, young, fit, deranged, is running as fast as he can, and he can't catch up. And eventually he gets frustrated and he bellows out, "Stop, monk, stop." And the Buddha calmly stops and turns around and looks at him and says, "Anguli, Mala, I have stopped. It's time for you to stop." And at that point, Angulimala catches up with him in a rush, and something hits him. Something cuts through the delusion, and he recognizes what he's been doing, and he drops to the ground in the Buddha's presence. And in that short conversation, the Buddha converted him from a mass murderer to a man dedicated to a life of harmlessness again as a monk. Kind of remarkable. So these stories can change lives. Breaking through someone's story can change a life. Angulimala enters the order of the monks, and even while hated, feared still by the villagers, right, who figure out who he is, he never tries to protect himself as he's getting stones thrown at him or fruit thrown at him. It's not okay to kill a monk in ancient India, so people did not exact revenge. Even with that, his practice was deep, and he ended up becoming fully awakened. Even after all of that horrific violence, betrayal, all of that. So I'm saying all of this to highlight that this person's deep story changed at least twice that we know of. And the effects on his behavior were dramatic, and the effects on those around him were dramatic. And it ended up, the power of his practice was such that he became sought after as a healer for women giving birth. You can imagine. He was able to still the pains of childbirth through his presence and his faith in the Dharma. So, there are other stories. But stories like this make me wonder if we might be able to have a similar kind of fierce compassion and wisdom with ourselves or people in our lives who might be acting in unhelpful ways to themselves or to others who might have been had their stories twisted by fake news, by events in the world, by their own trauma, whatever. That it's possible to meet someone with that kind of clarity and compassion. David Loy writes, "Unaware that our stories are stories, we usually experience them as the world. We take for granted that the world we experience is just the way things are. But our concepts, our ideas about the world, like the stories they are part of, strongly affect our perception of reality and our perception of others." So these are just a few of the deep stories of the Buddha. His capacity to metabolize his own difficulties, the difficulties of others, the challenges of practice, into wisdom, into freedom, into awakening. And just would like to invite all of you to reflect on the role of your stories in your life and your practice. Consider. Thank you for your kind attention. If anyone has questions, comments, additional insights, complaints, they're all welcome. Deborah, yeah.
You're right. I think probably most of us have heard some or parts of that or all of those, but it was wonderful to hear them again. And the wise heart metabolizes difficulties into beauty. That's going to stick with me. And I'm
Wonderful.
going to share that. That is really lovely. So thank you so much for that. I really love it and I really appreciate it. And I appreciate you. Thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. Thanks so much. Corey, yeah. Hi.
Hi, thank you, Dawn. I always love the story of I belong here. It's so moving to me. You know, it's so sometimes stories, they sound so like, wow, I could never do that. Or it's like they're pretty fantastic. But that one always just touches my heart. And I always feel like it's a real connection between sort of the heart space and sort of therapy space and, you know, kind of becoming your own in the world and the spiritual space. And so that one always touches me deeply. And, a good one for me to remember, so thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else? Yeah, Bowman.
Yeah, Dawn, thank you so much. All of those stories I've heard many times, but they really you bring a lot of light into it, into those stories again. I don't know. It's like during the meditation, I was thinking what came up. You know, it's just things that I wasn't proud of. You know, I don't know why they came up, but they did. And then, you know, the story of Ngulamare, you know, I think about things going on in the world today and how I can maybe have some influence on that. You know, we talk about, you know, having an influence on our grandkids and but I think it could go further. I mean, we always say, you know, we try to lead by example. And I think that's really, you know, your stories, you know, touch on that very deeply, you know, that our presence in the world can turn the tides. I'm reminded of Buckminster Fuller, who was an inventor, and he invented the trim tabs on great ships of, you know, that, you know, the rudder, it takes so much, you know, with the force and the momentum of a ship going through the ocean. You know, it's so hard to turn the rudder, but he invented trim tabs, which were small rudders on the side of the rudders that helped to break that resistance so that the rudder could, you know, so we could all be trim tabs to turn the great ship of state, you know. Thank you.
Beautifully said, Bowman. You know, it's uncanny. I was talking with a friend not even 3 hours ago about the trim tabs and how apparently Buckminster Fuller on his grave left something to the effect of "Call me trim tab." May we all be trim tabs. And you sussed out exactly what was underneath the stories. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much. It's
Thank you.
beautiful, beautiful. Your storytelling is wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. On the note of, oh, Barbara, please.
I just wanted to say how much I appreciated the retelling of these stories, because when they're retold, just the sight different emphasis or a different word can open up so many things, like your emphasis on relationality or relationship with the lady, the young woman who gives the Buddha the milk, rice, or whatever, I forget what it is. Anyway, it sort of takes her into a whole different reality and becomes part of his enlightenment. And then sort of the negative relationships of Agulimala, when he was ahimsa, and he was sort of transformed in terrible ways by, you know, his envious friends. We used to really see how the stories can change in for the negative too. And so I thought that was all just sort of wonderfully said. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. There's a quote. Some of you may know the Nigerian poet and author Ben Okri. He writes, "Change the stories individuals and nations tell themselves and live by, and you change the individuals and the nations." Right. So this is to both of your points, Bowman and Barbara, right? Like, the narratives are powerful. They change behavior, they change lives, they change perceptions. Anybody else? Yes, Deborah.
I want to thank Barbara and Bowman for what they said, but I also thought it was worth mentioning, it might be worth mentioning, that there has been a lot of talk lately about how our stories keep us stuck. And it's so interesting to me that you've had this topic tonight, and it's very reinforcing. And I'm not only thinking about my own story, but I have a friend who I've known for 25 years, and she's still telling me the same stories. So I'm going to ask her to listen to your talk, because she's suffering, and then I'm suffering because I have to listen again and again. It's interesting that there has been recently a lot of talk from psychologists and neurologists and other people online about sticking to your story and how that keeps people stuck in their minds.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said. Thank you. Anybody else? Oh, Vivian, hi. You're muted. You're muted. We can't hear you, Vivian. You're muted. Oh, okay. Okay. You're working on it. Got it.
Okay. Oh. The first, I don't know how coherent what I say is going to be, because the first thing I tried to do was unmute somebody else. And so that didn't work at all. Okay. Sorry about that. I would like to talk about my own personal story transformation. When you started, Dawn, I thought, I have no story. Never have. Can't imagine what it is. Who knows? And just before I brought myself back onto video, it was like, oh, that's where my story is now. And it's really different from before. And I'm trying to think of how to tell it succinctly in the major points, because I'm the kind of person who talks from one detail to the next, and then you would all go home. So the main theme in my life since, over 30 years, for the last 30, 35 years, has been a chronic pain condition. And early on, it wasn't that bad, and I could deal with it under kind of, you know, like Tylenol. And I had a couple of very long remissions. So most of my life was an active life, just like other people's. But it wasn't until way later on that I realized what a grumpy, nasty, mean person it had turned me into. And not always, but often enough. And it didn't feel like that was really my story, because that wasn't my story when I had been younger. But suddenly my story seemed to have changed. And then jump way ahead to, I guess, about 5 years ago, or however long it's been since the pandemic, I don't know. I had always wanted to study Buddhism, but never had the time to really do it justice. And reading books, somehow I was missing something. Books didn't make it. Then the pandemic came, and I became extremely ill with major, I'm just going to say it just to give you an idea of the story, okay? I had complex spine surgery and developed the most amazing pain, blah. I don't need to say the rest, okay? And I'm never asking for sympathy when I tell that to people. I'm just telling it. So that was a big part of my story. That was like 17 years ago. And then I, as a result of that surgery, at some point, I had to retire from working about 5 years ago. And because I couldn't function anymore, the pain and the fatigue that it caused and the chronic fatigue. And so it was my condition and the da 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 and all of this. Okay. So, I was a generally positive person and I always tried to get through. But like I say, it didn't make me a nice person, even if I was positive or mostly. Then I started learning about Buddhism, mostly going to Spirit Rock, because suddenly I could go online and I couldn't even drive out there from Mill Valley. It was too painful to sit in a car for that long, or sit anywhere for that long. Okay. I'm really trying to give you a flavor of what it was like. And now, switcheroo, I have learned so much about Buddhism, not just meditation, but also about Buddhism through Spirit Rock. And I learned so many ways of functioning with pain and dealing with pain in meditation. Most of the time it doesn't actually work, but I had one really, really amazing experience where I was able to focus on the pain and remove it to a space somewhere in some dimension, and it was no longer in my body. I could still see it very clearly somewhere else, but I lifted it off myself.
So may I ask you, Vivian, if you would say one sentence of the transformation to who you are now, what would you say it is?
So
one sentence.
I can focus on anything, get stuff done, and I've turned into a really nice person.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Deep bows. That is not an easy arc of practice. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, see the appreciation. I hope you see it as well.
Yeah, I do.
Good.
Can I just say one thing? I know that there are people in this group, and I haven't been in the group very long. I know that there are people in this group who are suffering from chronic conditions much worse than I. I also know that my condition worsens on a daily basis and that one day I will be where they are. And I'm very grateful for the group, and I hope that someday Another transformation will involve my getting in touch with whoever those people may be and having some kind of a, I don't know, I think a support for each other.
Beautiful.
Okay.
Done. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Would anyone else like to share anything? Yes, Deborah.
Long-winded person, Vivian. You're not the only long-winded person. I just want to say that I too have had a condition for over 30 years and had to stop working early and get poor and live with pain and brain fog and all kinds of things. One of my gratitudes for practice and just plugging away at it, even when I think I'm not, is learning to live in the body with all its mishigas, all its suffering, all its misery, and let it just be there. I don't know if that's helpful at all. And of course, some days the pain is so severe, you just have to take a hot bath and as many drugs, herbs, and vitamins that you can and go to bed. I'm very grateful that I can, you know, I'm sitting in discomfort and stretching and breathing and this whole time. It's really hard for me to even sit still. And it starts when I open my eyes in the morning. But I'm really sort of happy and delighted that I can have that and not let it run me. I think that's the thing, is that it doesn't run me. I mean, if I have to rest, I have to rest. If I have to forego something, I have to forego something. And those are always sucky times. But I think one of the things Dharma practice and all our wonderful teachers and all of the teachings they bring to our Sangha, and just all the efforts of the people who've been running the Sangha for 1,000 years now. I think it's 20, but that's a blessing of practice for me, that I can be in pain, acknowledge it, maybe take some action to do something about it, know that my brain isn't functioning, sit down when I have to or lay down when I have to. But I have a little statue. I call her Princess Moving Forward. And she's next to another they're like American fairy tale statues. And she's the mother of compassion. And the other one is Merlin, the transformer of energies. Mm. And so I just ask them to be with me. And they're at the kitchen sink because I spend a lot of time there making tea or coffee or food or washing the dishes. And I get to see them most there. So I don't know if that's helpful. But thank you for sharing all of that.
Thank you, Deborah. I came in through the dukkha doorway as well with chronic pain 20 years ago to the practice. Oh, it's moving for me to hear what you're sharing and to know that the Sangha has been, many of you together for a long time and supporting each other, whether it's been explicit or not, with your practice and your presence and your care. It's not a small thing in this world. I do appreciate that.